Welcome to Going Antiviral, the podcast for the IAS USA, a professional continuing medical education organization focused on HIV and other viral diseases. I'm Dr. Michael Sagg, professor of medicine and infectious diseases at the University of Alabama at Birmingham and volunteer member of the IAS USA Board of Directors. Welcome to the Going Antiviral podcast. Today, March 4th, 2024, we are at the Conference for Retroviruses and Opportunistic Infections, otherwise known as CROI, speaking to Dr. Adi Arana, who's a colleague of mine at the University of Alabama at Birmingham, where she's a professor and associate scientist with the UAB Center for AIDS Research. Adi, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
All right. So our topic today is what to do with that population of patients who, for whatever reason, have trouble adhering to daily, even once daily therapy. And we have now, 80%, 85% of the patients at the 1917 clinic who are undetectable or have controlled viremia, but that 15%, maybe 5% who just, despite no side effects that we can tell from the medicines, just have trouble keeping up with that. So you've conducted a study that'll be presented here as a late breaker at the CROI conference on patients who are struggling with the issues of adherence to single therapy once daily. And tell us about how the study came about and what exactly the question is that you were trying to answer.
Yeah, no, it's really a challenge that we have as providers to see how we can create an environment that reaches the patients where they are, right? And so, as you said, the vast majority of the people who come to clinic are taking their medications, and yet there continues to be this sort of solid group of people who come to their appointments or intermittently engage with their appointments but cannot take their medication. I think the other point to recognize is that group of people is not always the same group of people. So somebody, the sort of patterns of engagement can shift. And when they come back or they're going in and out, what we're welcoming them back into is essentially the same system that did not meet their needs or their adjusting needs as they went forward. So what we were thinking of doing is how can we change what we're doing? I mean, the big thing, and Ryan White clinics are really at the forefront of this, is providing the wraparound services that are needed. So addressing behavioral issues, mental health, substance use, and social determinants of health, such as housing or transportation. I think Ryan White clinics have done a great job of that. That's why comparison to, you know, other clinics, our outcomes on these particular measures tend to be better. But we continue to have these challenges. And so what else could we change? And so I think the holy grail is that combined biomedical and behavioral intervention that could potentially address these daily pill adherence challenges that we have and have been replicated in other fields like mental health, certainly, and in a contraception. And so with the development of long-acting agents, that was one of the first things that came to mind, is while they were in development for overall efficacy and treatment, could this be with a combined behavioral combined behavioral intervention, a strategy to address their need and this population?
So the long-acting that you referred to in mental health might be an IM injection once a month, or an implantable chip, or not chip, but implantable product that would be for contraception once every 90 days or 180 days. This is now an injection. It's actually two injections in the deep IM intramuscular that can be given initially once a month and then every 2 months. And this is the cabotegravir rilpivirine product. The challenge is that for the package insert, what's been approved is that you're supposed to start that medicine, the injectable,
when people have controlled viremia, that their virus is under control. Yet a vast majority of people who really need this because they have trouble adhering to once daily regimen are not undetectable. So how did you all dance between that requirement and the population that you're referring to?
Yeah, and that's precisely the question we wanted to try to answer. And I think the other thing to note is there's this undefined period of stable on oral antiretroviral therapy as well that's required. So not just your last viral load was undetectable, but that you've been stable and you haven't had any treatment failures in the past. And so when we're trying to engage that population that you're talking, you know, that we've been talking about here, they absolutely don't fit that criteria. So when we first developed the study, which was, by the way, prior to even the phase three studies starting to enroll. So protocol development really started around 2015 with a full approval to develop in the summer of 2016. And Atlas and Flair started enrolling that fall. So we were sort of making our study design almost parallel with the phase three designs in those clinical trials. And so one of the things is we needed to get them to undetectable. And so we divided the study into four steps, with the first step doing just that, is the goal is to get them undetectable. And we have extensive data on the effectiveness of conditional economic incentives in getting people suppressed.
In other words, you pay them.
You pay them, right? And this is implemented in all across the country, around the world, funding streams of are different, you know, sources. But the challenge with conditional economic incentives in HIV care has been that the impact of them stop when the incentives stop, right? So as long as you continue to pay, you tend to have better outcomes. But if you withdraw them, then you might return back to where you started. So what we were thinking is we need to get these patients to long acting. We need to fulfill the requirements of getting them to undetectable and then moving them on. So as a time-limited intervention, could conditional economic incentives support these patients, or combined with comprehensive adherence support, as we talked about, get them to where they need to be in order to get the long-acting strategy?
So every person that you recruited to the study received this payment to get to undetectable, and it worked in how many? What proportion?
So when we first designed the study, we were mirroring the designs of the earlier phase three studies, where that step one in the naive trials was 20 weeks. And what we found was that in that version of the protocol, only about 60% were making it all the way to the end. And more interestingly, what we found was people were achieving suppression, but they couldn't maintain it. Mm. So they would achieve it, say, by week 12 or week 8. But at our time point of week 20, which is where we needed them to be in order to randomize, they were no longer fitting that stringent criteria, right?
That's interesting. So the 60% who were sustained under control with the virus, that's the population you then randomized to get either the injectable, as was the pivotal trials that were ongoing at the same time, or they were randomized to go back to oral therapy.
Or yes, at that point they left the study. Now, what we did do after we got this data is to show, one, I think we were recruiting the right people. This is a very challenging population. Despite conditional economic incentives, we're not able to maintain their viremia. But again, going back to meeting the patients where they are, what could we do to our study design that more reflected what was going on with this population? So we did two things. We shortened the interval of step one. So we shortened it to week 12. initially. And that stringent less than 50 copies was also removed. By that time, we did have more data in the phase three studies. We started enrolling in March of 2019. And so at CROI in 2020, you know, we had more more data on what was sort of happening in the other phase three trials. So the entry for randomization was reduced to less than 200. So those changes, and then eventually with version three, moving it back to actually week four.
Wow.
As soon as week four. So again, trying to address that question of how soon do you really need to be undetectable before you can get long acting?
Okay, so when we get to the randomization of what you're presenting at this meeting, it was people who were struggling with adherence, who were all placed on incentive compensation to get their to take their medicines. They got to the point of less than 200 copies by week four, and boom, they got randomized.
They get randomized.
So that's the population.
That exactly right.
And half got the injectable and half continued on oral therapy.
On their oral therapy.
All right, everybody's waiting to hear what happened.
So we had our planned interim efficacy analysis with our data and safety monitoring board, and they've been looking at this data since the beginning, of course. And what they found was, so we have our primary endpoint is a combined endpoint of regimen failure. And so that includes people who have virologic failure, but also treatment-related failure. So they stopped the treatment essentially for whatever reason. So and we chose that because this is a population that has lost to follow-up, right? And so we wanted to be able to capture that because our goal is that this strategy was going to reduce that as well. So we wanted to be able to capture that in our primary endpoint. And so looking at that data, we had people in the long-acting arm had less failure compared to the people in the standard of care arm. But the analysis in the data, in the efficacy analysis, are looking at what's called stopping criteria, right? So the study is designed to see if long-acting strategy is superior compared to the standard of care. And so to stop the study, it has to be a fairly stringent
impact,
right? Very robust. So not what we are designed for our primary analysis. So on that specific primary endpoint, the confidence intervals did cross zero, you know, and the range was to like 0.8, sort of over. But when the DSMB looked at the key secondary endpoints of just virologic failure, and there were only six in the long-acting arm and 28, I believe, in the standard of care arm. In addition, looking at treatment-related failure, which includes like adverse events, also significant in the long-acting arm compared to the standard of care arm. Looking at that combination, the DSMB said that the long-acting strategy is superior to standard of care, and they recommended that we halt randomization and offer all the participants long-acting therapy.
And so that's what you did. So the vast majority did really well.
Did really well.
Okay.
Did really well.
So this is a really important study because it gives us insight into that critical population. And to put it into the broader context, we're really trying to get to zero transmissions in the community. And to do that, theoretically, every person who has HIV is known to have HIV. They're all on treatment, and all of their treatment gets them to 200 copies or below, and it stays there.
Right.
And if we do that, we stop transmission of HIV. So this is, if people are having trouble maintaining with a single pill once a day, having this as an alternative, that suddenly we get this 6 out of 140-something people not making it. But conversely, the vast majority having success who weren't having success before, that's a major leap forward.
It is. And I will say that, so in our study design, you mentioned the interval of the injections. We maintained a monthly injection interval. Okay. So everyone continued. We did not transition individuals on the study to every other month. And part of that was, we know the history of these participants' experiences. And part of it was we wanted to continue to engage them. There were concerns in the study design about the development of resistance in these individuals for loss to follow-up. And so that's sort of what the framework was, but balanced with, are these participants going to come in every month? You know, where this is a challenging population. And as I'll present later, we had 93% on-time injections. 93% of these participants came in every month for their injection.
So this is a...
93% of the injections, not the participants. It was great. Higher, but yes.
So let me unpack a few of the things. So now translating from the clinical trial world where things are controlled and there's extra support and people are signing informed consents and some people refuse to, so mm-hmm. they lost that group.
Sure.
But in the real world, if you will, in effectiveness studies or looking at how it works, the major thing that I think everybody in a clinic is saying, well, we can't afford to pay our patients who are having trouble to take medicine even for 4 weeks, just isn't feasible. So they're now dealing with a situation where people don't have controlled virus and they want to start the injectable that's sort of against the FDA recommendations for approved recommendations for the patients. Who come in with detectable virus over 200 copies. What's your thought about that sort of harm reduction concept, just starting the injectable? Your study didn't evaluate that, but the ISUSA guidelines group just came out and said, you know, that's, you got to do what you got to do. Do you find that that's bothersome or troubling, or do you think that's reasonable?
I mean, I think, Mike, you know, you have years of experience where you had to do what you had to do, right? When before there was fully, you know, active antiretroviral therapy and even in the interim when we had high level of resistance to various classes and we didn't know and you had to do what you had to do. And so I think that guideline really falls under essentially what would be considered compassionate use in some ways, right?
Yeah.
And I think that's right. And I think that even before the guidelines, people were doing this. The challenge, of course, being when you don't have guidelines, you don't really know what you're doing. And so there's people in different parts of, you know, the country and even the world that would really like some guidance, even if I'm going to do this in a compassionate use sort of format, how do I do it? And we have we have compassionate use data already out, you know, of course, with Ward 86 and as was cited in Mississippi, but even ViiV has published compassionate use data on exactly that population, viremic, unable to tolerate oral or unable to take any oral medications. And so does it come with reservations? Of course it comes with reservations, but at the same time, these are people who need it. So for me, it kind of falls under that category of care.
So let me take the term compassionate use. What we're really saying here is that these clinics on their own identified this population and said, we're just going to go for it on a compassionate use basis. So they started treating precisely as I just said, where they have detectable virus and they don't have a way to get them with oral therapy down to undetectable or even below 200. So we're just going to go for it. The risk being that nobody was 100% sure, maybe we still aren't to a large degree, that starting an injectable therapy, that the rev up, if you will, of the availability of the drug to bring the virus down may put that individual at risk for the virus becoming resistant to the intervention. But they, in those relatively small but meaningful studies, they didn't see much of that.
That's right. Yeah. And I think that is reassuring, but as you said, small, right? I'm involved with several cases where it's actually been the opposite, right? Where it's been just this, long durations of viremia, a lot of ART exposure in the past. And it was sort of a, you know, let's try and do a Hail Mary here in this case. Sometimes not exactly fitting that criteria of the CD4 being so low or concern for that. And now we are dealing with the consequences of that, and I'm providing input. Those don't necessarily get aggregated and published, unfortunately.
Right.
You know, it's the successes are getting published. And that's why I think guidelines are important to at least acknowledge that this is going on and to sort of attach some, okay, consider this for people who are not in the literature, don't know all of the resistance mutations, don't know exactly what to look at in terms of exposure. So I think that's there. But so even with a success, I think we do have to be a little cautious and informed about what we do.
And as I'm playing back the commentary we've had through this podcast today, I'm realizing that the way I framed the desire to get 100% of people to less than 200 copies, I put it in the global context of reducing transmission. But really, the primary reason to treat somebody and get them to that stage is for their own personal health.
Absolutely.
And that's the number one reason. Oh, but by the way, mm-hmm. we stop transmission. So I want to make that clear. So for just kind of wrapping this up, we have these new technologies that are just fabulous. And when I think back to 40 years ago when I was seeing patients in the 1980s, we had nothing and then AZT, and that only worked for a year and a half. Mm-hmm. And then people were dying over and over, just right and left. And it was demoralizing, and people were really losing hope. And now, 40 years later, we've got not only medicines that you can take one pill once a day, but we have injectables and more things that are going to be presented at this conference of longer acting therapies that can last for a week or a month, or maybe another conceptually 6 months.
Right.
And that is that's a huge game changer for especially the subpopulation of folks who struggle taking a pill once a day.
I think you hit the nail on the head where we are evolving our treatment to be so much more patient-centered. And that's the goal, right? That's the primary goal, is being able to make our treatment in a way that our patients can take it and improve their health and, you know, potentially we would assume their quality of life as well. And I think having those options, right? I through the years of doing the study, you know, I've gotten a lot of comments about whether it's going to work, whether it's not going to work, people are not going to take this, it's not going to work for everyone. And it's not going to work for everyone. And that there's nobody who thinks it's going to work for everyone. There are going to be people who are going to be able to accept this and benefit, you know, and benefit from this. And there are other people going to say, why would I come in for an injection when I can just take a pill at home? And that's right. We have to, again, you know, meet the people where they are.
That's the entire point, because I'm sure there are people listening who are saying, what is so hard about taking one pill once a day? How come folks can't do that? And what I think about, and I'm just admitting this, when I think about a lot of my patients who became close friends over time, who died, who would have benefited mm-hmm. from these newer therapies, and I ask myself, what would they have done? What would they have said if they could have taken one pill once a day?
Sure.
Wouldn't they do that? And yet there is a population who are struggling with that. So having these new options is just a godsend in a way. And I just want to congratulate you on having the foresight with your team to think about this back in 2015, before it was known that this intervention of the injectable was actually even going to work. And having the perseverance to push it through, make the adjustments, do these innovative methodologies of paying people to get their virus down. I mean, a lot of innovation there, but mostly patience and persistence. And congratulations on that.
Thank you so much. The team, like I said, working for probably over 9 years at this point. And I think beyond what the data shows to do with these products, the other big paradigm shift that we would love to see happen is that when we are continuing to develop these modalities, these very innovative delivery strategies, that this population is not the afterthought, and that in the initial applications and designs and trials that are conducted, we are actually recruiting this population. This study shows you can recruit and engage this population in a large treatment trial. We can do it. And so I think we're pushing now the spotlight on all of these new studies that you mentioned, every 6 months, you know, whatever is going to be developed, to we implore everyone to target this population, not later, but at the beginning, and particularly the viremic population.
Well, thank you very much for taking time out of your busy day at the conference here. Good luck with the presentation. And just very happy that you guys did what you did.
Great. Thanks for the opportunity.
Thank you for listening to this episode of Going Antiviral. Catch up on earlier episodes wherever you listen to podcasts, and check out the video versions of this episode and others on the IAS USA YouTube channel. You can find these links in the show notes, or simply go to YouTube and search for IAS USA, and there they are. Be sure to subscribe, rate, and review Going Antiviral on Apple Podcasts. This podcast is for informational and educational purposes only and is not intended to serve as medical advice. Opinions expressed in this podcast do not necessarily reflect the opinions of the IAS USA or its affiliates. If you have a question you'd like answered on the show, you can send it to podcast@iasusa.org to be answered in a future episode.